And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Well, President Obama's 100 days are up, and like any terrific marriage, following the honeymoon, it's about time to get down to brass tacks and recognize that our new president, while still so much better than the old president that you really can't even compare the two, it's light and darkness, still, he is not perfect. He makes mistakes, and perhaps nowhere was that more clear than his decision yesterday not to release the pictures that he said he was going to release, the pictures of United States torturing people. And Nancy Pelosi is on the hook regarding what she knew and when she knew it. We're going to talk about that, too. And also talk about what's going on in New Hampshire with the governor, John Lynch. I called his office yesterday, and I wonder if I had an effect. Lots to talk about. In the second half of the hour, I have a honored guest. He's coming straight from Hardball with Chris Matthews right here on the Horn. His name is Congressman Joe Sestak. He's actually been on this show before. He is a Democratic congressman from Pennsylvania who is rumored will run against Arlen Specter. Now, to be fair, Joe Sestak is not a liberal Democrat. I think it's fair to say he's more of a moderate Democrat. In fact, he has a higher military ranking than anyone in the Congress, having been a three-term admiral in the United States Congress. But he is certainly much more of a Democrat than Arlen Specter. And you have to understand that Pennsylvania, while a blue state, is more like an indigo state, I think it's fair to say. It is definitely not as true blue as, say, Massachusetts or Maryland. Pennsylvania has often been described as having Pittsburgh on one side, Philadelphia on the other side, and Alabama in between. So he's got to represent his state. I understand that. But I do think, for the fact that I have some differences with Congressman Sestak, he would be leagues better than Arlen Specter. He has not announced that he's running, but I hope that we can all encourage him to run, because it would be much better to have someone who is closer to the liberal fold of the Democratic Party, certainly closer there than Arlen Specter ever is. So he's coming on the second half of the hour. And well, there's so much to talk about. Let's start with the torture pictures. By now you know that Barack Obama has said he doesn't want to release the pictures. He doesn't see what good it would do. He's afraid that if we release the pictures, people will be less likely to take pictures in the future. Now, wait a minute. Wait just a minute. If you don't believe you're doing anything wrong, why would you be ashamed of taking pictures, right? I mean, if you think that these enhanced interrogation techniques are legal, if you think they're not torture to waterboard someone 183 times, if you think it's fine to bash someone's head against the wall or strip someone naked and place them in a stress position and hang them from the ceiling, if you think that's all fine and dandy and you're protecting America against terrorism, you should be proud to film it. Yesterday, I talked about my disappointment with how the Pope did not apologize for what his people and his church did during the Holocaust. And in the course of that discussion, I talked about the fact that German soldiers would send postcards home to their girlfriends of them shooting at a woman and child, cowering naked. You see, if you don't think that the baby and the mother are human and you like to kill them and you think that you're helping to cure the world of vermin, you don't see anything wrong with it either. The Nazis took ample photos and documents and movies of their killing. Indeed, most of the records that we have of the Holocaust come from the Nazis. They took meticulous records. And the only time that they started to destroy them, frankly, was at the very, very end of the war when they knew they were going to lose and they knew the Allies were coming. The same could be said for the CIA. No, I'm not saying that our crimes rival the Nazis. But I am saying that torture is a crime. It's definitely not an American value. And if we want to rid ourselves of it, what better way than to see the documentation, to see the pictures, if they're disgusting and horrific, as I expect them to be, What better message could it be to our policymakers that the American people don't like this kind of stuff? You know, the latest polls show America is not at all certain about torture. It depends on how you ask the question, to be sure. But pretty much half of America thinks that in some situations torture may make sense. Half say it never makes sense. And you can tweak the numbers and tweak the questions and get it to 40 or 60 either way. The pictures are not just for policymakers. The pictures are for Americans. Not you folks on the horn. We get it. But perhaps those that hadn't really thought the question through. Who is Obama protecting here? His administration didn't do torture. His administration's banning torture. He's protecting us from future administrations if he releases the pictures. And I hope that he'll turn, he'll change his mind. If he doesn't, well, go ACLU, sue him. Use the Freedom of Information Act, get those pictures out. Because the logic of Robert Gibbs is illogical. Robert Gibbs' logic seems to be, if we let these pictures go, the next time people do things that they think are illegal or wrong, they won't take those pictures. But Gibbs, if they thought it was illegal or wrong, why did they do it? And if they didn't think it was illegal or wrong, then why shouldn't they mind taking pictures? Nancy Pelosi has been on a hot seat herself about this question. She's been on the hot seat as to what she knew and when she knew it. And while those are fair questions, I think it's important to point out who's raising them and why. Most of these questions are being raised by the right, not the left. Some on the left are raising the question. Most of these questions are used as CYA, cover your rear, I guess. The purpose of raising these questions, and you've seen Dick Cheney on the air. I mean, Dick Cheney is doing the worldwide tour. He's on the air more than the Miss California or Joe the Plumber. Here, Dick Cheney was hiding in some bunker and not coming out during the entire Bush administration when he was in control of the country. But now that he's no longer in control, bingo, he comes out. I guess kind of like Darth Vader would come out after his Death Star is destroyed. But he's on the air all the time, and what's he saying? He's saying it was justified, it was fine, and Nancy Pelosi knew about it. You see, the Republicans are using her as their excuse. Now, I don't mean to let Pelosi off the hook. I don't mean to say she's not at fault. But I do think it's important to recognize her institutional limitations. Should she have done more? No doubt. And I'm going to play her explanation for you in just a minute. Her explanation is that she was told that these things were legal but not being used and should be warned next time they were used. Apparently an aide of hers was warned a few months later. By then she was no longer head of the Intelligence Committee. It was up to that head, Jane Harman, to write the letter of opposition, and Congresswoman Harman did. But the thing is, writing a letter was all the Democrats could do. And was it a CYA move on their part? Absolutely. Jane Harman gave a CYA move. Senator Rockefeller of West Virginia gave his own CYA move when he wrote in hand, "I oppose this." Nancy Pelosi, no doubt, should have written her own CYA letter. I don't doubt that. I don't dispute that. But I do think it's fair to ask what good it would have done. I mean, if you don't inform a majority of the committee, if you don't even let a majority of the committee know what's going on, they can't take any action. Harman filed her letter, Rockefeller filed his letter, and yes, Pelosi should have written a letter too. Does anyone think the Bush administration would have listened? So for all the crocodile tears of Dick Cheney, Nancy Pelosi knew about it. What could she have done? The only thing I think she could have done, I like to think she would do this, if she could have come on air and said, "You know what? I've been told something in secret. I'm not allowed to talk about it. If I talk about it, I breach my legal obligations. They can put me in jail. So all I'll tell you is I think that the administration is doing something that's illegal and wrong, but I can't even research it because they won't let me tell my lawyers about it to research it. So it sounds illegal to me, but barring relieving me of institutional constraints, I can't tell you what it is, and I can't do anything about it. I'm sorry, America. Please ask the government to relieve you of institutional constraints so I can tell you that it appears that they're breaking a very fundamental law and value of the United States. Wouldn't that have been fun? That's a speech I think she could have given. One that wouldn't have violated her requirements. Maybe it would have. Maybe they would have brought criminal penalties against her. I don't know. Put her in jail for saying that? But I could just see CNN say, you know, what is it, Nancy Pelosi? She'd say, you know, I think the president's breaking the law, but I'm not allowed to tell you why. Ask him to allow me to tell you why, and I will. Wouldn't that have been fun? In any case, let's hear her story now. Because, like I said, I recognize her institutional constraints. She's not off the hook as far as I'm concerned, but I do think she's certainly a far lesser evil than Dick Cheney. Of course, everyone is far lesser evil than Dick Cheney. Let's listen. This is Pelosi's explanation.
I unequivocally oppose the use of torture by our government because it is contrary to our national values. Like all members of Congress who are briefed on classified information, I have signed oaths pledging not to disclose any of that information. This is an oath I have taken very seriously, and I've always abided by it. The CIA briefed me only once on enhanced interrogation techniques in September 2002 in my capacity as a ranking member of the Intelligence Committee. I was informed then that the Department of Justice opinions had concluded that the use of enhanced interrogation techniques were legal. The only mention of waterboarding at that briefing was that it was not being employed. Both conducting the briefing promised to inform the appropriate members of Congress if that technique were to be used in the future. Congress and the American people now know that contrary opinions within the executive branch concluded that these interrogation techniques were not legal. However, those opinions were not shared with Congress. We also now know that techniques including waterboarding had already been employed and that those briefings made in September 2002 gave me inaccurate and incomplete information. The Bush administration has conceived a policy as the CIA comes to the Congress, withholds information about the timing and the use of this subject. We later find out that it had been taking place before they even briefed us about the legal opinions and told us that they were not being used. This is a diversionary tactic to take the spotlight off of those who conceived, developed, and implemented these policies, which all of us long opposed. My action on it was to further to say we have to change the majority in Congress, have to win the White House, so that we can change it.
Just to be clear, you're accusing the CIA of lying to you in September of 2000.
Misleading the Congress of the United States.
And also
misleading the Congress of the United States.
Well, it's a pretty big charge, actually, misleading the Congress of the United States. And it's hard to know who's telling the truth here. I will say that I think Nancy Pelosi is splitting hairs, much as maybe Bill Clinton once did. We know she was told in September 2002 that they thought waterboarding was legal, and she wrote a letter protest at that time. Then she becomes the minority leader of the House at that time, the head of the Democrats. She was informed originally as the chairman of the Intelligence Committee in 02. By 03, she's head of the Democrats. And an aide of hers apparently is informed that they did some waterboarding. There's some dispute there as to what she knew and when she knew it. But I do think institutionally she was under tremendous constraints. I've already told you how I think I would have handled it. One thing I do find interesting, though, is that Pelosi is not hiding from an investigation. She's calling for an investigation. And to me, that's a sign of someone who really, she doesn't fear an investigation. And I think that's the right way to go. This thing needs to be fully investigated. What will happen at the end? I don't know. Probably very little. Already, there are memos out in the Justice Department to suggest that John Yoo, Stephen Bybee, Bradbury, all of them There's really no criminal action they can take against these lawyers. And you know what? It's probably right. But you can take away their law licenses. Remember what they did to Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, they tried to accuse of perjury, which is a felony, a criminal offense, when he misled about his affair with Monica Lewinsky. Did he outright lie? I don't know what he did or he didn't. I'm not sure. I don't think it was perjury, because in order to be perjury, you have to lie about a material offense. I explained this way back when it happened. I'll give you the brief legal analysis now. It's really not that hard to understand. If you ask someone on the stand, or the witness stand, did you, did you break that priceless vase, and someone says no, and they did, well, that's perjury. That's the subject of the lawsuit. That's what matters, and they lied under oath. That's serious. But if you ask the woman on the stand, what's your age, and she says 50, when she's really 60, that's a lie, and it's under oath, but it's not perjury, because her age is not relevant to the lawsuit, the question of whether she broke the vase or not. Now, had it been a question of Social Security benefits where her age mattered, then it would be perjury. I bring it up because Bill Clinton clearly did not commit perjury. Did he try to mislead people about whether or not he cheated on his wife? You betcha. And for that alone, not for committing perjury, but for probably lying under oath, the Republicans managed to take away his law license. They went to Arkansas, they complained, the Arkansas State Bar took away his law license. At the very least, and I realize this is a slap on the wrist, we have got to take away the law license of John Yoo. Take away the law license of Bybee. I don't know how he's going to serve as a judge on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals without a law license. But I don't see why the California State Bar can't go after him. John Yoo's a professor. How are you going to be a professor without a law license? I don't know. These things can do real damage. No, we don't put them in prison, which I'd like to do. But for frivolous legal opinions that they knew were false at the time they signed it, well, that's what you'd have to show. You'd have to show that their opinions were beyond any colorable opinion. Now, we all know in the law there's lots of ambiguity. There's lots of different ways to view the law. But John Yoo, my old classmate at Yale Law School, his legal memos truly take the cake. The thing I found most hilarious, in a very sick way, is when he used a Medicare statute and a Medicaid statute to define severe pain. See, you know, the Geneva Conventions tell us that we cannot cause severe pain. That's what torture, one aspect of torture. So John Yoo said, what's severe pain? Well, Medicaid only lets you pay for an emergency room if you have, if you're going to lose a bodily organ. In other words, you may be in severe pain, you may have broken your arm, but unless, you know, your heart's in danger or your liver function's going, unless you're about to die, Medicaid, Medicare won't pay necessarily for emergency room. So John Yoo took that statute, which has nothing to do with torture, and said, oh, that's what torture is. That, to me, is beyond the pale of legal opinion. As for Pelosi, is she trying to cover her rear end right now? I'm sure she is. I'm sure she is. She should have covered it earlier. And she's right, and it's perfectly fair to criticize her for it, but I do think it's important to remember why it's being brought up now. For the same reason that it's important to know why Dick Cheney's on the news right now. When it was going on, Dick Cheney was in his underground bunker, letting no one know about it. Now that it's out in the public, now Dick Cheney wants to talk about it. Oh, you caught me in my crime. Well, now let me give you my excuse. I want to talk about a couple other issues before I bring Congressman Sestak on the air. One is what's going on at Notre Dame. I'll just say this briefly. Notre Dame, I guess I should say. I'm used to the French version rather than the the American version. where people are protesting President Obama because he favors a woman's right to choose. You know, there have been lots of other presidents at Notre Dame before Barack Obama, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, Jimmy Carter. And many of them, the Republicans, for example, support the death penalty, which is as opposed by the Catholic Church as abortion. How come they didn't complain when they spoke on that? I just want to briefly mention what's going on in New Hampshire. I called New Hampshire Governor John Lynch's office yesterday. I did it because I was trying to figure out what was going on with the New Hampshire marriage bill. As you may recall, the right of all people to marry, gay and straight, is now the law in Massachusetts, Connecticut, Iowa, and Vermont, and then Maine became the fifth state. And in New Hampshire, the legislatures of both the House and the Senate passed the bill, and it was unclear whether the governor was going to sign it. In fact, I was trying to figure out since it had been 5 days if it would go into law without his signature. Turns out that the woman on the phone told me that they hadn't enrolled the bill yet, which was basically a technical thing that was giving the governor a bit of time to make up his mind. The governor, who is a Democrat and supported civil unions, was, well, kind of like Barack Obama, hoist on his own petard. I don't doubt that the governor supports marriage equality. Most Democrats do. But they see it as an issue that, well, its time is coming, but its time has not come yet. It's an issue on which about half Americans support marriage equality and about half do not. Depends on what poll you read, by the way. Washington Post ABC News poll said that 49% of Americans support marriage equality, 44% against. The CNN poll said that 54 are against and 44 are for. So it's kind of right down the middle, and politicians want to avoid the question. But how could Governor John Lynch avoid the question? The legislature had signed the bill. He had three choices. He could sign it, he could veto it, or he could let it pass into law without his signature. All three of those options were fraught. If he signed it, then the conservatives would say he flip-flopped on the question of civil unions and he was bowing to the homosexual agenda. If he let it pass without his signature, he'd be criticized by both sides, both by the right for allowing it to become law and by the left for not vociferously signing it, for being part of history. And had he vetoed it, of course, that would have angered gay people in New Hampshire and across the country, and the legislature would then, I guess, try to override it. He was in a bind. He was in a political bind. And with people like me calling in and encouraging him, and in fact, one of the things I want to do is give out the number, because the Baptists are giving out the number. I'll let you call the governor and tell him what to do. And that number is 603-271-2121. I'll repeat it again when I'm through with this topic. But the governor came out with an amazing thread through the eye of a needle. I gotta credit his political skill. He didn't pick option sign, option let become law without signing, or option veto. He picked option four, an option we didn't even know was on the list. He said, amend the bill, and I'll sign it. And what amendment does he want? He wants a perfectly superfluous amendment that doesn't change a damn thing. The amendment he wants is to counter the lie told by the religious right that if there's marriage equality in New Hampshire, churches and other institutions will have to marry gay couples. Now, that is a lie for a lot of reasons. For one thing, it's opposed to the First Amendment. The First Amendment allows churches to marry whomever they please. Catholics can refuse to marry non-Catholics. They can refuse to marry Catholics who won't raise their children Catholics. Orthodox Jews can refuse to marry non-Jews. Muslims can refuse to marry non-Muslims. Churches can prohibit interreligious marriages. Churches can prohibit interracial marriages. After all, the Mormon Church held that blacks were not good enough to be Mormon until, I think, 1978. Maybe it was later, more recent. So if a church of the KKK wants to only allow lily-white people to get married, and you have to prove your genetic heritage to, I don't know, England, because, you know, France, well, can't trust those French, they can do that too. You could have a church of the left-hander that says no one right-handed can be married in this church. You can have a church of, I don't know, the blue-eyed people a church of the tall people. We don't marry anyone under 6 feet here. You could have a church of, you have to be high to get married here? Drug church? You can have a church that says anything it wants. I'd be curious to know what the flying spaghetti monster, who they want to marry. Maybe you have to eat so much pasta a day. That is the absolute right. And no one, certainly no one in the gay community, no one in any community is trying to force churches against their will to marry people they don't want to marry, or mosques or synagogues or temples or any other religious institution. And we couldn't if we wanted to, because of the First Amendment. Now, I, for one, have advocated that, the synagogue that I belong to marries gay couples. That's my right as a member of that synagogue, and they do. And I would hope that you do that within your churches, but that's not something you can use the government to do. Now, Bob Kincaid is telling me that the Flying Spaghetti Monster Church, that they insist on strippers and beer at every marriage ceremony. All right. Good for that, Bob. So the governor, I think, did a very clever political thing. And I give him props for this. I give him points. He insisted on that an amendment be added that does absolutely nothing but get rid of the concerns of people who have no right to be concerned, right? The minister said the lie that, oh, no, if we allow married couples, gay couples in New Hampshire, then our churches will have to marry gay couples. And that was a lie. So the governor says, all right, then I'm going to insist on an amendment. And my amendment will be, notwithstanding any provision of law, you can't force a religious organization or individual or priest or minister or rabbi or anyone directed by it to marry anybody or allow facilities to anyone who's not married the way we say. We can refuse accommodations. We can hold it. We can also kick them out of our country club, which, of course, they'd have a right to do because that's your freedom of assembly, freedom of association. Frankly, it's the same thing the Boy Scouts case showed. The Boy Scouts could and did very cruelly kick out gay people. But they have a right to do it as long as it's a private club. So I don't know what the governor's going to do. I guess he's going to veto this bill, but he's going to say, bring it back with my amendment. And I think they will. And it'll be passed, and so it's going to be another 3 to 6 months. But by doing so, he goes to the right and he says, hey, yeah, see, I protected your religious rights, see? And I slowed it all down, and he can say to gay people, it doesn't change anything. You'll get it. That's a politician. He threaded the needle. And you know what? I'm not even upset about it. I mean, I'm upset that marriage equality will be delayed 3 to 6 months in New Hampshire. I don't like that. But I give the politician credit. He saved faith. He managed without changing anything that matters because the law wouldn't require religious institutions to do anything. Anyway, he managed to pretend like he was helping the bigots at the same time as he's actually signing marriage equality. And I'm going to go one step further and say that it's time for Barack Obama to follow John Lynch. See, he could do that, too. He could say, well, I agree with Governor Lynch. We've got to protect religious institutions. But, the state shouldn't be prejudiced. What's interesting is I don't think Barack Obama will ever have to actually decide this. Like John Lynch, Barack Obama wants to avoid the question. And as he is not the governor of any state, it will not come before his desk unless it comes from the District of Columbia. All laws passed by District of Columbia, unlike the 50 states, the District of Columbia, of course, is occupied territory. The people of D.C. are ruled by a Congress. All of their laws can be overturned by Congress. And the people of D.C. don't even have a representative in that Congress. Kind of sounds like tyranny to me. But it's a small area, and so most Americans don't even know that these American citizens have no rights of representation. Talk about people who need a tea party. But what's interesting is that even though Congress has a right to overrule D.C.'s law, I guarantee you They won't touch it with a 10-foot pole. There's people in D.C. that are concerned. Certainly Congress has the right to overturn it. I don't think they'll touch it because Democrats know that Barack Obama doesn't want to touch this. He doesn't want to sign or veto it, just like John Lynch didn't. And so Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid won't put Barack Obama in that place. That's why I'm not worried if D.C. passes the law. I think it will be the law in D.C., and I expect you'll see that, let's say, by August. That's my best guess. Definitely by the end of 2009. But the problem is that Obama, by staying silent, does give credence to the people who are opposed. I talked about this yesterday and the day before, the fact that there are people out there who are making this a racial issue, who are claiming that somehow blacks should be more opposed to this than whites. That somehow blacks hate gay people more than whites. You saw Marion Barry say this. He predicted that all civil war would break loose. He said the black community is adamant against this. Well, we'll use the John Lynch compromise. We'll make sure that it's very clear, even though it's already clear, that religious institutions don't have to do anything they don't want to do. If they want to be racist, they can be racist. If they want to be homophobic, they can be homophobic. If they want to sacrifice virgins, no, I don't think they can do that because that involves murder. But basically anything else they can do. They can exclude anyone they want. And unfortunately, Obama's quietness is encouraging a lot of the bigots. I don't know so much if it's encouraging it, except that they're using it. They're using the influence of the president to support their bigoted agenda. And I have no doubt that come 2013, after the re-election of President Barack Obama, that he's going to come clean and say, all right, yeah, I do support marriage equality. I recognize that separate cannot be equal. Coming up any moment, but not quite here yet, will be the congressman from Pennsylvania, Bart Sestak. Excuse me, Joe Sestak. There's another congressman named Bart. Joe Sestak's going to come on the air any moment, and we're going to talk about a lot of things. We're going to talk about the economy. We're going to talk about Pakistan and Afghanistan. We're going to talk about his view on what our inspector has done in his state. I myself would like to encourage former Admiral Joe Sestak to run against Arlen Specter. Maybe y'all can call in too at 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366, and encourage him to be a real Democrat and to take out the old Democrat, the new Democrat, whoever he is, Arlen Specter. He's an old man. He's a new Democrat, although he actually was a Democrat back in the 1960s. Now, Joe Sestak, it's important to know, is not just an admiral, a three-star admiral, the highest-ranking military man ever elected to Congress. That's important. Not just in Congress now, the highest-ranking guy ever elected to Congress. This is the guy who was actually on the ground in Afghanistan and Iraq conducting operations. I think Constance Sestak would probably understand more than most of us what's going on in Pakistan right now and what, if anything, can be done to prevent the spread of the Taliban in that country. I am concerned about it. You should be too. Pakistan is a new democracy. It's only 1 year old, and it has nuclear weapons. Now, a year ago, there was a dictator, Musharraf. General Musharraf ran the country, and he was a good friend of President Bush. And as usual, we have no problems with dictators. American presidents generally don't. No problem with dictators. They can torture their people. They can mistreat people. As long as there are bastards, as Franklin Delano Roosevelt famously said, we're okay. He may be a bastard, but he's our bastard. Well, Saddam Hussein used to be our bastard. Marcos used to be our bastard. Noriega used to be our bastard. These were dictators who were cruel. The Shah of Iran, another example. dictators, cruel to their own people, tortured their own people, put people in jail without trial. Currently Mubarak of Egypt or the king of Saudi Arabia. I can give you an example after example after example of dictators that are cruel to their own people, but just fine for American foreign policy. And by the dictates of realpolitik, we tend to support these people. And as I said, we're doing it today. Well, General Musharraf is one of those people until, lo and behold, a wonderful thing happened in Pakistan, and you've got to give the credit to the people of Pakistan. A very, very large nation in population, very powerful nation. Militarily, as I said, it has nuclear weapons. The people of Pakistan basically overthrew their general and installed a president. Now, they would have installed Benazir Bhutto, a woman, indeed I think the only woman ever to run a Muslim country, who had been a former prime minister and who was really the face of democracy in Pakistan. But she was murdered recently, and now her husband's in charge, and I don't know that her husband is quite as good a leader as, well, as she was. But let's hope that, well, he can pull it through. We now have the congressman on the line. Congressman Sestak, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Well, thanks for having me. I regret I'm a few minutes late, and my apologies.
Oh, I understand that you were just on Hardball, in fact.
Yes, to discuss the issue of, well, I thought it was going to be two issues. One was detainee photos, but it turned out principally to be on the recent item on Madam Speaker Pelosi of what she, about the torture and who knew what when.
And what are your views on that?
On. I mean, I think it's my job, part of my job, is to go on and explain to people what I think is right or not, because basically I work for 700,000 people, my constituents, and I enjoy this process, as I do tonight with you.
Just briefly, what are your views on the Pelosi and the torture pictures?
Yeah, on the torture picture first, what I've said in the past is that I had felt that they should be released, but I understand President Obama in one aspect wanting to delay them, but it should be temporary. Now, why delay? I do accept that at this very precarious time of what you were just speaking about, Pakistan, which is on the verge of being a failed state, with the Taliban owning Swat Valley, and with an insurgency growing, and with nuclear weapons and 2,000 trained scientists at the core of it, that, as we remember with the Danish newspaper publication of certain pictures that inflamed, understandably, those of the Islamic faith, that maybe now, because of this national security issue of inflaming a populace that doesn't look favorably upon us at all right now, we can hold off, but only for a bit of time. I believe, like any good military effort, you always have an exit strategy to measure the success and the failures. At some time, we need for transparency to the public, like I began this conversation to say, look, here's what occurred. You have the right to know. We work for you. But I can hold off it, but it should be temporary until we try to get this situation and the president's in Delta weak hand a little bit more under control.
So temporary, like a year or two? Are you thinking like a year or two or longer?
I don't know. I think about a year, we're going to know. Here's why. The problem, as you probably well know, I didn't hear all your conversation on Pakistan, is how do we get their military to stop being focused upon India, where they have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of troops stationed, and have them focus on what's really threatening their government and society, the counterinsurgency? The one area that, you know, well, let me just say it this way. It's sort of like Samuel Johnson said, there's nothing like the prospect of a hanging to focus your mind. Well, in a very ironic way, the success of the Taliban and what they've done as they moved out of the Swat Valley more towards Islamabad has actually forced the two political parties, the intelligence service and the military, begin to come together to focus on that threat. If that threat evolves a bit slow rather than rapidly, there's still the opportunity for the government to do two things: focus and retrain its military towards the counterinsurgency, And number two, begin to ensure with our assistance, because I just voted on the bill today, this Defense Appropriations Bill, with quite a bit of developmental and counterinsurgency assistance, but the developmental assistance begins to take hold in the tribal areas. This is not a straw man has been dealt, or the president has been dealt, but it is really what we can do. And so that, I think we should see some traction within the year.
In terms of developmental assistance, I saw the Pakistani ambassador to the United States, who's on John Stewart last night, and he says that basically it's sort of a winning of hearts and minds kind of thing. He doesn't think that the military he supports a military effort, but he doesn't think that can be done alone. He says that basically the people actually get higher payments to join the Taliban than they do to join the Pakistani police or soldiers. That half of the children of Pakistan don't go to school. And that these developmental problems are what's causing the population to turn to the Taliban rather than the elected government. Do you think he's right?
Yeah,
and do you need to give? Okay. So does this that you voted on today, does that help in that regard?
It helps in both regards. The bill we have today has $400 million in one portion of it for counterinsurgency efforts on the part of the Pakistan, because in the meantime, you just can't educate people in one day. It's going to take years of effort, so we must have a military effort. But there's also an equivalent amount, $400 million, being given to the State Department for developmental assistance. Now, there's more than that, but I'm just picking out one particular area. There is a few billion dollars that we will be working towards in Afghanistan and Pakistan to developmental assistance. You know my background, 31 years in the military, before I got out 3 years ago to run for Congress. And I've always known that militaries don't fix problems. We stop them. But if you want to fix a problem, it's the other elements of our power, from the power of our economy, the power of our ideals, the power of the rule of law. And I was on the ground very early for a short period of time in Afghanistan. I saw what needed to be done, brought my carrier battle group back, went back on the ground 18 months later, saw what hadn't been done because we shifted our attention to Iraq. The point was we removed the edifice of security of some of our key military types, special forces, civil affairs forces, that not only give security but can begin to help civilian elements within that prism of security begin to do the assistance, the developmental efforts that begin to grow the grass that grows into trees of stability in a society that functions. Without a question, this is going to be a hard sell to make sure everybody understands that this will take some time. But in the meantime, we have to have an army in Pakistan, not ours, theirs, that can at least protect the government, because they were moving up towards 60 miles away. So you need both, but in the long term, if you don't have development assistance, you'll never succeed.
Congressman, a lot of times when we describe what's going on in Pakistan, and frankly in Afghanistan as well, it's described as a religious war that the Taliban wants to prohibit women's rights and to impose Sharia law. And no doubt that's true. I don't dispute that. Well, one thing that's virtually never discussed, and I know you know about this because you were conducting operations in the region as a three-star admiral, you know the situation much better than I'm sure a lot of people in the press. But what's not talked about very much is the ethnic conflict. The majority of Pakistan, as you know, is Punjab. They're the ones around the capital. They're in Islamabad. And the people in the mountains are Pashtun. They are a different ethnic group, and an ethnic group more aligned with the Taliban than with the Pakistani government. How much of this is an ethnic conflict?
I think you are, first of all, if you're the only one who really ever I've heard really bring that up, except for the few experts I've had asked to come to my office before hearings to make sure I have a better definition of occurrence, it is part of the issue. And it also flows over into Afghanistan.
Because they're Pashtun.
Yes, and they don't recognize any border. And so what you have here is that they just recognize where their ethnicity is. And so this is why we have a dual problem. For us, the issue is no longer really Pakistan as well as what threatens America directly today. It's where the Al-Qaeda have a safe haven in Pakistan, because they're not in Afghanistan any longer. However, the ability to be accepted by one of the ethnic groups, and then they transition back and forth across the border that nobody even thinks about, is, so if we stamp them out in Pakistan, that's not good enough. We have to have built enough of a society and gained the ethnic support that they can't flow back and forth. You add that on to the issue of ideology that becomes attractive to individuals that no longer have a job. It's why Admiral Blair, head of the D.C., the director of Central Intelligence, said wisely, I thought, in January, the number one threat to U.S. security is economic instability around the world. There's hundreds, as another example, of young Muslim men who over the past 8 years were working in Russia on their oil fields as they began to control more dominance in, have more of a dominance in the oil markets. And now so many have been laid off and they've come home to Tajikistan, for example, but they don't have any work. They don't have enough money to get married. So then they become attractive, not just to the, even their ethnicity, their tribe does no longer hold onto them as much as an ideology that promised them something to be for. And that's the danger as Afghanistan sits in the middle of this, borderless at times, because tribes or ethnic groups tend not to recognize borders. This is a real conundrum.
Well, you know, I remember back in Iraq when we were very much afraid, and I'm not saying that we're out of the woods yet, it may still happen, but we're very much afraid about a civil war between Shia and Sunni Muslims. And, of course, the Shia are the majority of Iraq, but we helped the Sunnis, the minority, the ones that, of the same group as Saddam Hussein, with what's been called the Sunni Awakening. Some describe it as part of the surge. I think a better way to describe it is simply we paid them off. We gave them a lot of cash to fight with us rather than against us. And also some promises of autonomy. Do you think that there can be a Pashtun awakening where the Pashtun, which is a separate ethnic group, and I'm all for giving ethnic groups their autonomy, should have some kind of autonomy from the central government, not to persecute women, not to have Sharia law, but some recognition they have a separate ethnicity, they have a separate language, maybe some money to help build their own institutions so they don't have to rely on the Taliban. Can we use that strategy in Pakistan?
Pakistan is going to be a little more difficult than it would if we were doing that strategy in Afghanistan, which doesn't have a government that is a central government that has any sort of cohesion at this time. And I think you're going to see items like that developing more on the low autonomous level in Afghanistan. In Pakistan, it's not going to be able to be worked. Conceptually, yes, but it can't be worked out quite that way because we cannot enter Pakistan. We may have 30 or so trainers there of their army, but our setting a foot in there like we did in the Sunni land, you might call it, at least when I visited it was so Sunni, we called it Sunnistan, right. In Iraq, is it will only inflame the population.
No, and I agree with you. I'm just wondering whether we couldn't, for example, the Pakistani army, am I correct in saying that it is mostly Punjab? Could there be a Pakistani army made up of this ethnic group of Pashtuns so that they feel more comfortable and they don't feel like an occupying force?
Yes, you could. If you relied upon the Pakistanis to do this, and that's what it was done, you could have some elements of this being worked out. The problem is going to be, again, those two parties, that intelligence service and that military, is how do they look at it? Because unless they all agree, our trying to use our influence there is very limited. And that's our problem. When we were in Iraq, we kind of had the say. And in Afghanistan,
we've
got a pretty large say. As a matter of fact, we will give more now if they give more. You know, we will do more in development assistance if we see results. Pakistan's a different conundrum.
How do you think President Obama is doing with regard to Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iraq? Grade him on that, if you would.
I think I have to give him at least a B plus A minus in the right general approach. I think, however, two items. I think there should be a bit more, and there probably is, it's not aware of it as quite of yet, effort upon any influence we can with India. Because India is the country that Pakistanis focus upon. And whatever we can have India do to alleviate concerns of Pakistan will go a long way. Number two, and this is important.
India's an exit strategy.
I think, you don't need a date certain, but I think after two long wars, Americans deserve a set of benchmarks that give us a feeling of what is a success and what is a failure. Because this is going to continue to be costly, and I think it needs to. But overall, I'd give them at least an A-. And who am I to say, however? But I am very taken with the emphasis and the understanding that it's about the developmental assistance in the long term. It's about turning the army towards counterinsurgency. And those are the two key things. And I'm also encouraged, which I've been advocating, give the unmanned air vehicle control of them, even pull in the trigger for the missile that comes off of them when they fly over Pakistan and see an Al-Qaeda operative to the Pakistani army. Every time we do something and it's our trigger, we lose more. And the paper had today or yesterday that we now have at least dual control, I understand. So we are taking good steps.
And are you confident that Pakistan's nuclear weapons are under lock and key and we're not in any immediate danger of them being given over to the Taliban?
I am comfortable of the bit I've been allowed to know in this position that they do have them under pretty secure key. However, my concern is the 2,000 scientists I alluded to that are work on the core of the nuclear parts of their nuclear weapon program that have access to the labs, not just in knowledge, but of radioactive material.
One of them will go bad.
Scientists have been recruited from the radical universities within Pakistan because they've been fairly radical for over a decade or two. And so who are they? What can they do? What can they kind of move around a little bit? Not the weapons themselves, but knowledge and material that's radioactive. That's my concern.
I hear you, and I think it's a very good concern. I'm sorry to interrupt you. We have only about 8 minutes left, and I got so many things I want to raise with you. First of all, briefly, the economy, the stimulus package. How is that helping your constituents in Pennsylvania, or is it not working very well?
No, we are beginning to see the positive effects of the stimulus bill, where the tax cuts that were issued have begun to be used by individuals in the retail side. We are seeing that the unemployment benefits that were extended is being spent, and we're seeing that the food stamps is being spent. So there's a little bit more retail business going on right now. Number two is the construction. I think we missold it. This was not a stimulus bill as much as stop the hemorrhaging of jobs bill. The construction will be taking effect more at the end of this year. But third, let me give you a simple, we gave $80 billion in Medicaid funding. Why? Because governors of states couldn't afford to pay hospitals their Medicaid share of the bills of people coming in for Medicaid, as one example. By us giving that money, instead, in my district, for example, Crozier, a hospital, was about to lay off 400 nurses, custodians, others. It now only did 82 because we gave cash to the governor to pay his Medicaid bills, for example, and less are being laid off. With less laid off, you have people still having income to spend money in the shops as they get tax cuts, etc. So it's beginning to take some effect. But of more importance, probably, is the credit side. We can say what all we want, but the fact of the matter is the mother milk of our economy, credit, is beginning to flow, slowly but flow again. And you can see it in small things, like the banking rate has fallen dramatically. So we are seeing some things begin to get traction in our economy.
Is it because of the bailouts? I mean, they were absolutely necessary. Do you think that the credit is increasing because we gave
billions
of dollars?
Without a question. I voted for what you understandably called the bailout last September.
The TARP.
It finally came out. They get the money. For that day that I voted for it and it failed in the House that day, LIBOR, the overnight lending rate, which is usually at 0.2%, rose to 6.7% that afternoon, that evening. That day, the federal credit reserve printed $687 billion. So legally, banks could open the next day because they couldn't borrow money from anyone else. because the overnight lending rate, nobody bank wanted to lend another bank a cent because they didn't know if they'd be open the next day. Only by getting that money, and I will not defend it's that is being pure 100% accountability. We tried. We didn't do the best job. But without that, the lights in America would have been turned off. Here's why. That first week in October, not one bond was issued in America. The first time that's occurred in the history of America. No, without a question. Was it done poorly at times? Things done in a crisis usually aren't done perfectly. But that credit has really begun to have, that effort in credit and putting money out there into the banks has kept America from going, shutting its lights off. And I strongly, and the modeling does that. My advanced degree is political economy. I don't do this because of just looking at what happened with Japan and Sweden and the SNL crisis of the 80s or the Great Depression. I ran the models. I looked at what models said. And without having done this, It wasn't the best thing to do, but it was far, far better than doing nothing.
Congressman, this is Bob Kincaid. I want to ask you briefly to this the political situation in Pennsylvania.
Sure. Absolutely.
And I realize it's probably a rather sensitive area for you. There's a lot of talk out there suggesting that you would be an appropriate challenger in the primary for Arlen Specter. Can you address that?
Absolutely. I was disappointed in the Washington political establishment of my party, the Democrats, that they felt they needed to reach over to an individual who had been in the Republican establishment for about four decades and then tell us Pennsylvanians, here's your future. I just did not get into politics because I felt that our independent decision-making was going to be taken away by an establishment. So that has moved me more close to getting into this race. But I said, and I will continue to do so, although I haven't been moved away from my concerns, that I will wait to see what Arlen Specter is running for. What is the health care proposal that he believes in? How is he going to fight for the right educational future and opportunity for our children in Pennsylvania? Because they're not staying. And you can see that because Pennsylvania now is up there with Florida as the oldest in average age of the citizens of the state, of the states, of the union. What is he going to do for alternative energy and our environment? And unless those answers are addressed well, and number two, we feel we can rely upon him, not this year only, but in 2012, 13, 14, 15, 16, then I will get into this because I believe that the next few years are so important to my district and to us Pennsylvanians as a whole that we cannot entrust this to someone who we feel we may not be able to rely upon. And number two, has not the right policies for us Pennsylvanians. We're going to decide this. And so that's what I'm working through. Haven't made my final decision yet. And I just feel it isn't theirs. There's no kings and no kingmakers in America. And so we're going to work this through together, us Pennsylvanians.
Well, Congressman, that is, and I am, this is not false praise or lightly given. That is an answer that makes me feel a surge of pride, quite frankly, because it mirrors a lot of what I, too, have thought. May I also raise a couple of other issues that you didn't touch on within the calculus of whether or not you get into the race?
Sure, absolutely.
Two issues, one of which, one of the issues that the Horn, the network that you're on right now, is the single most unwavering voice for working people broadcast-wise in the United States.
Yes.
Senator Specter came out and said that in no wise would he support the Employee Free Choice Act.
Right.
Can you address that topic?
Yes, the Employee Free Choice Act is one that I have co-sponsored. I actually voted for it in the last election, Congress, and it comes out of my committee. The issue is that the National Relations, NRLB, National Relations Labor Board, is broken. And there's not the proper enforcement of the right of workers to unionize. Now, people may agree or disagree on that, but the fact of the matter is they have the right to unionize by law. So what you find is that approximately 60% of those that want to have a secret ballot never get there because there is of groups that try to organize, because in 60% of the cases there are actual firings or pressure placed upon those who are trying to organize by employers. Second is what you have is that after they get to the right, after they've won a secret ballot, about 40% of those unions that have groups that have voted for union never get to a contract. And so this bill was supposed to make the field much more fair. And so that's the issue here, is that it's not really about labor. It's about working families. And the reason I'm concerned about working families is in my district and all of Pennsylvania, 50% of the families, working families, the medium level of the income of our state, means that when you look at statistics, they are earning less today in real income than they did in 2001. That's not just today, 2009, after a recession of a year, 14 months. It was even 14 months ago before the recession began that they were earning less in real terms. Well, health premiums up 100% in that period of time, and the cost of public university education up 60% during that time. And you sit back and say, well, wait a moment. The great American dream that the next generation will have the opportunity, not the requirement, but the promise, but the opportunity to do better than their father and mother hasn't been met. And we need to address this issue, and this is a piece of it. There's so much more to be done, from healthcare to educational opportunity, but this is a piece of the future.
Well, I believe a week and a half ago, I spoke with a wonderful radio host in your state, a gentleman by the name of Rick Smith, out of Harrisburg, and he was talking about the fact that organized labor would effectively have no voice if Arlen Specter were elected Senate. And we had an extended discussion about the fact that working people, working families, as you rightly describe them, very much need advocacy and representation within Pennsylvania's Senate delegation. And I'm again proud to hear the way you discuss the issue. Finally, I would merely ask if, because I don't have the data in front of me, and I'll be very quick, Congressman. The Head On Radio Network is headquartered in West Virginia. Where I am speaking to you from right now is literally 2 miles from the boundaries of a national park, and 2 miles from a place where a coal company is currently blowing up a mountain to get at a 16-inch seam of coal. I wanted to inquire, because I don't have the data in front of me, are you signatory to the Clean Water Protection Act, H.R. 1310?
I will find out if I'm signatory to H.R. What was the number?
1310.
1310. Let me quickly see if I have. There's 5,000 bills, and I am co-sponsor of quite a few of them.
I can well imagine.
If I'm not, I probably should be, but I believe that I probably am. Look, what we need to do, and why I'm so glad about the economic stimulus bill and about what we're about to do in the president's budget, is that we need to put the research and development to make it an effective way to do sequestration if we are to use coal. And not only that, we cannot continue to devastate by how we do that. Hold on. I'm an original co-sponsor of the bill.
Wonderful. I wanted to check on that, because
we have to take care of the land. Oh, look, and personally, I think this whole approach to energy and the environment is a win-win if done right for business and the environment. When I got endorsed by the Sierra Club in my first election, I asked, where they were standing on my right, I asked on my left if I could have a businessman, which they said certainly, because it was a businessman who was with the firm that had at the time in my district the largest portfolio in America for investment portfolio for clean energy. These are the kinds of jobs that President Obama bodes for the future. And, you know, it's going to take time, but we should not be having Iberdrola, which is a wonderful company, Spanish-owned, establishing headquarters here and building windmills that gives us jobs. Where is our own businessmen and women being given the proper tax incentives that shouldn't be given to the oil companies, that should be given to the clean energy types like we did in the economic stimulus bill, so that they invest in it, and soon America is establishing windmill factories over in China or other places. This can be good for our economy. It can be good for our education, as we have the artisans now switching over to the proper type of nanofabrication for the solar power panels of the future. And it's clean for our energy environment, which means it's good for our children's future. This is a major issue that we need to continue to work on. Is one of the issues why I want to hear where Arlen sits on all this.
And I very much do as well, Joe. And I tell you what, I know you are pressed for time. I would like at some point, if you don't mind, to have a longer, more extended conversation on these topics with you. It has been a real pleasure for me. I really appreciate the time and the energy you've brought to this conversation, and I thank you very, very kindly.
Glad to be aboard again in the future, and have a great evening.
You too, sir. You too.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye now. That is Congressman Joe Sestak from Pennsylvania. I hope you like what you heard both in Mark's conversation and mine. He's a very genial man.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. Though he and I had a big fight last year, you may not even remember.
Now, I thought that was Bart Sestak.
Why would there be two Sestaks in Congress here?
Hey, you know it's what? Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, Sestak's probably like Smith.
I didn't know that. You know what? I think it was Bart. Because at one point I started to say, call him Bart, and I stopped myself. You know what? I bet that's the difference. Bart Sestak and I had the fight last year over whether or not to put Rove in jail.
Via inherent contempt, yes.
Right. But you know what? I just looked up Bart Sestak on Google, and that may not be him. I think it's the same guy. I don't think he remembered, and I wasn't going to bring it up because I wanted to be nice. And
well, I tell you, I gotta tell you on just about everything he raised, and you raised, and I raised. He got all the answers right from this liberal's perspective. Now
he's solidly pro labor and pro environmental issues, and he's the one though that it's. And I hope he answered this question while I was in technical hell. He's the one that I hope will challenge Arlen Specter.
Yes, he did. He is looking very seriously at that, and he did what a thoughtful politician would do. And I don't use politician like a dirty word in this sense.
He dodged the question.
No, he did not dodge the question.
No?
He said, I am going to see what Arlen does. I'm going to
see. That's a good answer.
He said, I'm going to see if Arlen stands up for working people. I'm going to see if Arlen actually does what's needed to keep young Pennsylvanians in Pennsylvania. I'm going to see if Arlen does the right thing on health care.
Well, that actually makes sense, because that way when he announces that he's running, he can say Arlen didn't do the right thing. That's actually a very good move. It's a very good move on his part.
I'm very pleased with him. He is, in fact, an original co-sponsor of the Clean Water Protection Act, H.R. 1310, which would effectively end mountain removal, not just in West Virginia, but in all of Appalachia.
Good for him.
He is endorsed by the Sierra Club.
I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad to hear it. It was Joe Sestak. I just did my research on my own website. This was the guy I disagreed with on that. But that's okay. Like I, you know, if I agree with every member of, there's no member of Congress I agree with all the time. I thought he was wrong on not pressing the contempt issue. But I've never doubted that he's an intelligent man, that he's a Democrat, that he's someone who I agree with most of the time. And one thing I did like is that he had a very clear understanding of Pakistan that I think, honestly, very few do have.
And you know what? No one is more vociferous, Mark, in wanting us the hell out of that region. Anybody who thinks that you can conquer or pacify Afghanistan, Pakistan, the tribal areas, has clearly never read a blessed word about Alexander the Great, because we ain't got no Alexanders in the Pentagon. Not a one. Not even close, okay? We don't even have Alexander's horse, Bucephalus, Oxhead. We ain't got him. We can't do it. It can't be done. But the place can be, if we go about it the right way, and it's some of what I heard him talking about, it can be rendered harmless.
Which is all we want. Which it should be all we want. I mean, that's the only thing that we have a right to want.
Yeah, see, I don't want Afghanistan to be the 51st star in the flag.
No, I just want it not to harbor people that come to us with planes and
But as long out. But as long as we're zooming through the skies, putting hellfire missiles on top of wedding parties. You know, that's the thing I never understand about the right wing, Mark. They're all about, well, we got to protect the sanctity of marriage. Well, as long as it's not happening in Afghanistan where we're putting missiles on them, because they're hypocrites, the right wing. But,
really?
Yeah.
You feel that way, Bob?
Yeah, this just in.
Because I've never heard you say that before. So okay, if you think so.
But anyway, there are ways to make Afghanistan and the tribal areas of Pakistan and Pakistan in general stable. But it generally does not happen well with the fumes of cordite wafting through the air.
Which is why I brought up two issues. One was developmental aid, education and giving people a chance, an opportunity, jobs, the same kinds of opportunities. You know, as I talked about the fact that they're actually paid more to work for the Taliban than they are to work for the Pakistani police and army, and also that half the kids are getting educated. And the other thing is sensitivity to ethnic differences. Which he complimented me for raising the question because apparently no one asked him that question. But one of the things that we never seem to understand in Vietnam, for example, is it wasn't that the South Vietnamese and the North Vietnamese wanted to be communist. They didn't really care. They just wanted we, the imperialists, out of there. It was respecting their own local issues. I don't think that the people of Waziristan are really that into the Taliban, or really that into Al-Qaeda, or frankly even that into Sharia law and the mistreatment of women under it. What they want is their Pashtun. It's a different ethnic group from the Punjab. They want a little bit of autonomy. And I think that once we start recognizing people's rights to autonomy, you don't have to give them a separate state, but simply the right to teach their own language in their own schools and practice their own traditions. I said this about the Kurds of Iraq. I said it about really any minority, the Basques, let that minority teach their own religion and their own culture, and usually they won't be pushing for their own state. So I was glad that he saw the ethnic issue as well.
As am I. And for some reason, I have lost. Well, at some point,
you're
I am
beeping.
Gonna, yeah, I'm beeping. I'm going to have to do a reboot at some point.
All right, I'm going to hang up then. And glad you enjoyed the interview. I'm always glad when I get members of Congress on the air, particularly an intelligent one like him. And I suspect, if I had to bet, that our inspector will try to go a bit to the left. He won't succeed in going far enough, and this man may be the next senator from Pennsylvania.
Well, if our fellow Horn host Rick Smith understands, and he's from Pennsylvania, so he should know that there is no way. I mean, unless Arlen Specter began behaving like that magic bullet that he invented. Arlen Specter can't get whatever half measure he does to try to engage in appeasement of the so-called left. It's going to be a half measure, and it is going to be insufficient. I'm guessing that if Congressman Sestak continues to speak the way he spoke today, that there is a strong likelihood organized labor would get behind him. I can't speak for labor, but...
No, I think they're already behind him. The question is what... by the way, it's Bart Stupak. That's why I was confused.
Okay,
it's
yeah.
Bart Stupak,
right.
Not a Bart Sestak. Sorry about that. But no, I think that at the end of the day, our inspector will try to do a face-saving move, much like the governor of New Hampshire did. And if it's a truly fig leaf, like I think the governor of New Hampshire, it's a complete fig leaf. It doesn't affect anything. It just delays everything. But it's going to happen in New Hampshire. I'm okay with it. If our inspector says, all right, we're going to have the Employee Free Choice Act, but we're going to call it the Employee Free Choice Law, and they can put the cards in, but they have to be signed by a notary, you know, something ridiculous like that. But if it does the intent of the bill, which is to allow the majority of people to unionize when they want to, Then you'll hear me talking good about our inspector. We'll see.
Well, but I'll tell you what. I mean, I know you're more of a gambling man than I am. I'll lay odds that that ain't going to happen.
I'm not going to bet you on that because I think you're right. It's not going to happen.
What would happen?
Is the opportunity to
as far as EFCA is concerned, Mark. What will happen is that Arlen might weasel a little bit to the center because ain't nothing about him middle of the road or moderate or liberal or any of that garbage that's been applied to him. That what he will do is I would predict that he'll say, you know, that lady from Arkansas, that Blanche Lincoln, the one that represents Walmart, I'm with her. Because what they've tried to do is put together this watered down version of EFCA that takes the 50% card check requirement and runs it up to like 70%, something like that.
No, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and they're calling it, well, you know, that's a moderate compromise.
Yeah, no, it's not.
No, that's a shiv through the ribs.
The other thing that Specter could do is he could say, and this would be fine with me, he could say, I'm going to vote against the Employer Free Choice Act, but I won't filibuster it. And you know what? If he does that, it'll pass, and I'm okay with that. If he's not part of the 60, so he allows it to get to the floor, and then the majority votes it without Blanche Lincoln and without Autumn Specter, that's a face-saving move.
That's the thing there. There ain't no 60, okay? Because Blanche Lincoln is a Democrat. David
right.
Pryor is a Democrat. Ben Nelson has already announced his opposition to it. Mary Landrieu can't be counted on.
You know what?
Yeah, and what we're talking about here is an overarching problem with no one so much as Harry Reid, Mark.
Oh, I can't blame Harry Reid for Mary Landrieu and
I can. He's the majority leader. You go to him and you say, you know that bridge you want built in your hometown? It ain't getting built. That's how hard, you know, you were praising LBJ yesterday. That's
right.
How he operated. He was,
that's
after
true.
All,
that
unless I am
LBJ
mistaken,
operated.
Was he not majority leader or majority whip in the Senate at one point?
Yes, but we haven't had a politician like LBJ since LBJ.
Well, guess what? Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
Harry Reid is no LBJ. We could definitely agree.
Well, you know, the fact that, I mean, I was particularly dismayed, and I don't know if you saw this or not, Mark. You know, there's ongoing, you know, Jay Bibee, Office of Legal Counsel, right? The guy
former.
Who's...
Former.
Yeah, but the guy who's now a federal appeals court judge who sat around in his office... nibbling cheese doodles and writing about torturing human beings.
Right.
His appointment to the Office of Legal Counsel was approved on nothing more than a voice vote in 2001.
Right, and now they're trying to stop Don Johnson.
Don Johnson, Harry Reid said yesterday, is going to have 60 votes because the Republicans won't let him otherwise.
Do you know what? She'll have 60 votes. I mean, it's not the right thing for them to filibuster her, but she'll have 60 votes.
She won't have 60 votes. She ain't got Ben Nelson. That's the whole point here, Mark. Harry Reid does not have control of his own caucus.
That's true, but that's normal. I actually think she's going to get it because I think both of the senators from Maine will vote for her to absolutely. I don't see either Olympia Snowe or Susan Collins turning on Don Johnson. She's not at all a radical. She's a very well-respected legal scholar. I think it's going to happen. But let me just say this, because I know you have to reboot, and then I'm going to get out of here. I do think the only option on the Employee Free Choice Act that helps save face of Blanche Lincoln and Mary Landrieu and Ben Nelson and Autumn Specter is for them to vote for cloture, vote for it to be heard. After all, just vote for a vote.
All we
That's
want is a
64,
yeah,
and then all of them can vote against it, because you know what? We have 50 votes. We don't have 60, but we have 50.
That is true.
That is the only face-saving solution. And you know what? If Harry Reid does that, I'm okay with it.
And you know what? In the process, the best way to handle that is to just play videotape over and over and audio sound bites over and over of Bill the Cat Killer Frist repeating in that simpering accent of his on the floor of the United States Senate, "All we want is a up or down vote."
Exactly. Put in the reconciliation bill. Then you get an up or down vote. There are other ways to skin this cat.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you for finishing the interview. I'm sorry to hear about your sheets of rain, and I wish we had a way to prevent technical problems, but given that they happen...
Well, there is a way to prevent technical problems in large part. It's called money.
Well, go into your pitch then and get our listeners to help you out.
Indeed, I'm going to try. Mark, we'll talk to you later, brother.
Thank you, Bob.
Bye now. Mark Levine, host of the Inside Scoop.